A long time ago, a beautiful young woman in Arabia was taken by a sultan as one of his harem. And this guy had a nasty habit of keeping his wives for only a one-night stand. Then he wasted them the next day. Unlike her unfortunate predecessors, this gal had the wit to go with her looks. And on her first and soon-to-be last night, she persuaded this person to let her tell him a story. And just when he became engrossed in it, she stopped right in the middle of it. So he let her live another day to learn how the story ended. And the next night she told him the story and finished it. But she immediately began another one, and another, until she continued for 1,001 nights. And thus she kept death at bay by telling the stories that eventually became known as the Arabian Nights, about a captive who captivated her master with stories. Parables have a way of being redemptive. And I feel a kinship with that woman. It's been my privilege the last 8 years to tell the stories of Jesus to the people of God for 16,790 nights. And because it's Sunday morning at First Baptist, I'm going to tell you another one. Because you and I have been involved in an ongoing story, an old story, of First Baptist days and nights, telling the stories of Jesus in season, out of season. Underlying our stories lies a common need to make sense out of life, including the good times and the bad. And each Sunday we come to this old meeting house to open ourselves to the Scriptures, to allow them to provide us with a lamp for our feet and a light unto our paths. And I just love it. Perhaps Moses' story in the wilderness can speak to us on our journey in these remaining days. Landmark occurrences come in each of our lives, usually centered around some unexpected event. In modern terminology, we might say that God sent a fax from heaven to Moses in the form of a bush on fire that wouldn't be extinguished. And there he encountered a God who cares about the oppression and the suffering of his people. And not only that, but he's willing to get involved in the stream of history, to do something about it in order to reach a larger goal of his redemptive purpose. And that's where Moses comes in. This bush not only burned, it could talk. Looky here, son. I got something for you to do. And what would that be? Said Moses. Ah, nothing much. Just pilfer Pharaoh's slaves out from under his nose and then teach them how to be a light to the nations. Moses had something that qualified him to be someone who could release captives from bondage. His Hebrew heritage played a role, no doubt, and his Egyptian training obviously prepared him. And still, in spite of all that, he was overwhelmed with the enormity of his mission. So he wanted to know, if I got to go before Pharaoh and take on the strongest person on earth, by what authority can I cite that I am doing this? And God said, I am. I am who I am, and that'll do just fine. Moses wasn't satisfied with that, and neither would Pharaoh be, so he started throwing out all these excuses as to why he couldn't do it. He'd be ridiculed. He was a poor public speaker, and besides, he really enjoyed the pastoral life of shepherding out in the desert just fine. Going up against Pharaoh was the last thing he wanted to do. Finally, God had enough, and he just said, well, if I wanted a perfect leader, I wouldn't have picked you in the first place. And it seems odd of God to choose somebody as incompetent as Moses to do a very important work. But God can make experts out of any of us if we're willing to let him. The biblical writers allow us to look in on Moses' struggle with his new vocation. God needed somebody with sensitivity and guts. And Moses had those characteristics. He felt for the Hebrew slaves, sacrificing his palatial background, foregoing a life on the easy street. God likes stuff like that in a leader. He was, by temperament, a defender of the underdog. God likes that in a leader. And after whacking an Egyptian guard for mistreating one of his kin, Moses had to flee for his life to the anonymity of the Sinai desert. But changing locations didn't affect his skills. He still had the same skills. And there too, wherever he went, he was a sensitive defender of the underdog. When he arrived in Midian, he came upon some guys bullying Jethro's daughters by the well. And instinctively, Moses stood up for them. And as fate would have it, one of them became his wife. This was his natural inclination to alleviate the injustices that he saw. And God said, that's what I'm looking for. But when he got diverted into a life of looking after the sheep, it just seemed a waste to God. He could do so much more with his life. Why settle for so much less just because you made a mistake back in Egypt? And then one day, Moses stumbled across that fiery theophany. And to his everlasting credit, he did this. The writer says he turned aside. That means he didn't ignore it. Only then did God speak. Did you notice? Not until he turned aside. Maybe if we turned aside more often, God would speak to us with more clarity, don't you think? And isn't turning aside what we do here every Sunday? We're turning aside from the world out there to let God speak to us like he did Moses. So God goes, what's it going to be? We spend the time you have left shepherding sheep or telling Pharaoh to let my people go. God's job is to get us to a place where we can put our skills to their best use. Our job is to genuinely be ourselves, like Moses was. Wherever he went, he was genuinely himself. And to be ourselves so that we can utilize the gifts God has given to us. Because the questions are the same for us as they were for Moses. Moses, every man, every woman. What do I enjoy doing? Is this something I'm good at? Is this something that the world needs to be done? That's the sweet spot. Where we're all looking for that sweet spot where we can live life at its fullest. Will I and can I and how can I make the best use of the talents God has given to me? That's a question for everybody. The story of the Exodus took 40 years to complete because there was some dead wood to shed. So they took the long road to Canaan. And along the way, there were plenty of ups and downs. And the downs got to weighing heavily on Moses, and he became so frustrated that these stubborn Israelites, that he blamed God for all of the trouble he was experiencing. He shouldn't have done that, because that disqualified Moses from entering the promised land. On the way, he learned it's not a good idea to get on the bad side of God. But settling down in the promised land wasn't his gift anyway. That wasn't something he was good at. He was a liberator, not a settler. So Moses' story ends with him poised on the verge of the Jordan, up on Mount Nebo, but he never made it in. The best he could get was a glimpse of its splendor. And man, I've been there. It is splendor, even today. Even with the lack of trees, it's splendor. On Mount Nebo, he died. His mission accomplished. God used him up. There wasn't anything left to get from Moses. But he was one of two Old Testament heroes who, like Jesus, didn't have a grave. The other was Elijah the prophet. Both of these guys showed up again later at the Transfiguration. That's another story. Like Moses, we all have our Jordan rivers that we'll never cross. Too late gets stamped on a lot of plans we make. Back when we were young bucks, we could do anything. And before you know it, you're 70. Where did the time go? Moses never got to enter the promised land. After all he went through for God, that's the thanks he got. But Moses was bigger than that. And he learned how to accept God's, "Speak no more with me about this matter." And he gracefully came to terms with the unspeakable will of God. And really, isn't this a story about what do you do once you reach your limits? Moses ran head on into his limitations. We try to deny ours, but they're there. What do you do when you reach your limits? And that's when Moses stood tallest of all. And we'd see why God chose him. This time, instead of turning aside, he stepped aside. Why? So he could let Joshua finish the job. In any important human endeavor, there's always a Joshua. There's always in the wings a successor for Moses, for Jesus. All leaders are interims. Some just last longer than the others. But the time had come for Moses not to make progress, but to step aside. And he did it well. Step aside so Joshua could step up. The Deuteronomist wrote, "Charge Joshua and encourage him, for he shall go over this Jordan and lead my people." That seems pretty harsh. I don't like how this feels for Moses. You know, it seems pretty harsh. All Moses had been through, for the Lord to let somebody else complete what he started. But God has his reasons, known only to him. And Moses' story shows us that serving the Lord is like running a relay in track. First one, then another, advances the baton. Each participant comes along and advances it further, and then passes it on to the next one, then carries it briefly, then hands it on to a different teammate. They all know it's a team victory, not an individual victory. It's a team victory. In football, the quarterback gets most of the attention. But it's all about the team. Peyton Manning can't play in the NFL forever. Eventually, time catches up with all of us, and somebody's going to take Peyton's place. Ew. Y'all pray for Peyton. If he doesn't win today, my name's Mud. Please, Peyton, win one for the Gipper. In sports, in our families, believe it or not, kids eventually are going to grow up and leave home, Jason. That's what we're training them to do. We're training them to do, and then we try to hold on after they go, you know. In our jobs, people move around for improvement. In our schools, students graduate. They come here a while and move on. In our churches, pastors come and go. There have been 36 of them here so far. But the church remains. You're joining the church, not the preacher. All of us are responsible for maximum effort during the span allotted to us on the lapse of the race of life that we have to run. We're not to run somebody else's race. We're to run our own race given to us by God, and we're to do it with maximum effort. We all have a modicum of power along the way, but sooner or later the time inevitably comes to relinquish it to somebody else. It is the natural evolutionary progression of existence in the animal world and the human world. I have immensely enjoyed the privilege of carrying the baton for these 10,000 days and nights among you. It's almost simple to have such fun in church. I won't go that far, but it sure is great. And I will not hold on to the baton after I leave. I promise you that. Even now, I am preparing to pass the baton on to number 37. We got as far as 36 and a half with Linda, if I might steal her word. Now it's time for 37. Whoever is blessed to occupy this sacred spot, this special spot, that person will have my absolute total support. But I trust our leaders to find that person and to ask God to lead them to find that person. So it fell to Joshua to lead the people across the Jordan. Wasn't in the cards for Moses to take them in. And there's a certain sadness to that. But Moses got a glimpse of the future of his people. He got to see the promised land that is flowing with milk and honey. And he realized that it's all about the promise. It's not just about the land. It's more about the promise. It's more about the place where we can put our gifts to their best use. And you know, and I know, this meeting house is that place for us, where we too can be used of God in our time. And God keeps his promises by using those who are available and willing to do it. Because the cause of God is way too big for any one man, any one woman, including Jesus. Way too big. And he has to use those who are willing. So Jesus said to his disciples, you remember, you will do greater things than I have done. And just shake your head at that one. He did some pretty great things. He said, you will do greater things, bigger than even Jesus. So I'm extremely hopeful that what began here on College Hill way back in 1638 will continue to thrive and bless the people of Old Providence in a unique way and a caring way that you're so good at. This church is the best it can get, folks. Right here, right now. And when you and I can be a part of something like that in our lifetime, something much bigger than we are, by helping to advance it along in our time, whatever future God has in store for the First Baptist Church in America, we too can have our peaks into the promised land, like Moses up on Mount Nebo. I am, well, that's God's proper name. God gave himself a nickname. Nicknames are much better than proper names. Transcendence isn't God's only way of being. Because he went on to say, after he identified himself as Yahweh, I am who I am, tell the Israelites, I am the Lord God of your ancestors who is behind all this. Think about it. God attaches his name to human names. He's the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Sarah and Rebecca and Leah and Rachel and Mary Magdalene and Martin Luther King and even the sign guy, number 36. And there's a blank space available to add your name to God's. Think about all the names that have been added to God. No wonder we can't speak his name. Based on this text from the Torah, the Jews think God's name is so holy, you can't pronounce it. But it may be for another reason. Could it be that God's real name includes so many of our names that it's impossible to verbalize? Mystery and revelation. Majesty and earthiness. Immortal, invisible, most holy God attached to our names. And if one fine day we should turn aside to see, God will call out to us. It's enough to give you goosebumps, or at least to stoop down and take off your shoes. And like the great Moses, we too can know that we have lived as fully as we can. May it be so.